Coming up is the news.
The Iranian president says the enemies use division and insulting sanctities to weaken Muslim societies, urging stronger Islamic unity in the face of such plots. The U.S. approves another military aid package worth $325 million for Ukraine, despite Russia's frequent warnings against such assistance. And a new attempt at a ceasefire between Sudan's warring sides fails, leaving people fearful of dwindling food supplies and a shutdown of medical facilities. Hello, everybody, and a very warm welcome to World News. Another Iranian president says the enemies of Muslim societies use division, terrorist groups, occupation, and insulting sanctities as main strategies to weaken those societies. Ebrahim Raisi made the remarks at an iftar banquet attended by ambassadors and chargé d'affaires of Islamic countries in Iran. He called on Muslim states to unite in order to counter such conspiracies. The Iranian president also strongly condemned Israel's criminal acts and recent attacks on the Al-Aqsa Mosque and against defenseless Palestinian worshippers. He, however, added mere condemnation is not enough and practical steps have to be taken in the face of Israel's crime to support the Palestinian people. Occupied Palestinian territories have been the scene of growing tensions in recent weeks due to Israel's atrocities and repeated raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. In response, Palestinians have also launched several retaliatory attacks. Daniel Yagich is an author and researcher, and we asked him about Israel's recurrent acts of violence against Palestinians.
The Zionist regime cannot exist and cannot survive without this continuous barbaric violence that it is inflicting on the indigenous Palestinians, and which it also is inflicting beyond Palestine, in fact. So we see that every year, as you mentioned, for major significant holidays, these humiliations and attacks and torture and killing of people at the hands of settlers and the Zionist regime, again, as part of this very colonial conquest, because the Zionist regime cannot sustain itself without this continuous violence on which it was actually built. The Zionist colony emerged through tactics of terrorism and genocidal killings and expulsion of the indigenous people. So it is very much the essence of, I think, what Zionism represents. There is no way to ever rely on the so-called international community, in particular the West, even when there were some maybe slight moments of some sort of criticism from the West. None of this has ever led to any actual actions being taken against the Zionist regime. On the contrary, actually, the Zionist regime serves as a proxy for the United States in many ways, as the European Union does as well. So, and we've seen again how Palestinian, Lebanese, and Syrian resistance are being condemned, and it's over and over again the same language used by the West and by the also the UN, which has a very imbalanced internal power relations.
The U.S. has approved another military aid package for Ukraine, despite frequent warnings against military support for Kiev from Moscow. New package is worth $325 million and includes ammunition for the high-mobility artillery rocket systems, or the HIMARS, some advanced missiles, and anti-tank mines. Now, this brings total assistance to the country to more than $35 billion. Washington has so far approved nearly 40 military aid packages since the start of the war with Russia. Kiev says it's also received a first batch of U.S. Patriot air defense systems. The Ukrainian military has deployed France's light armored fighting vehicles as well to carry out counteroffensives against the Russian forces. The West has so far provided dozens of billions of dollars in military assistance to Ukraine. Russia says the aid will only prolong the war and add to Ukrainian suffering. And staying with the Ukraine war, Russia has warned South Korea against sending weapons to Ukraine after Seoul raised the possibility. And the Russian former president, Dmitry Medvedev, warned that Moscow will send weapons to North Korea if Seoul provides military assistance to Kiev. The Kremlin spokesman also made similar remarks, saying that South Korea's arms supplies to Ukraine will mean indirect involvement in the war. Dmitry Peskov added that Seoul has taken a rather unfriendly stance. Meanwhile, the French president Emmanuel Macron has been loudly booed by crowds in eastern France. This came after he embarked on his first trip out of Paris since signing his unpopular pension reform into law.
Yes, I shouted and said that we'll fight to be able to retire at 60 and that the French, like all French people, will continue to show our discontent.
I didn't come to see him specifically. In fact, I wanted to make sure that he would see that we would be present at every one of his trips. We're not going to turn the page on pension reform. It's been 3-4 years that every time he takes a stand or whatever, it's worse. He annoys people.
As Macron arrived in Celestat in the Alsace region, locals chanted slogans calling for his resignation while booing and jeering him. Local man said that Macron's government is corrupt on a scale never seen before, telling the president that he will soon fall. On an earlier stage of his trip, the French police pushed back dozens of protesters banging kitchenware ahead of Macron's arrival in a village. Macron, however, seemed undeterred, telling reporters that such incidents will not stop him from making visits throughout France and going on walkabouts. Macron signed into law the controversial pension reform on Saturday, which increases the retirement age from 62 to 64 years old and makes it much harder to obtain a full pension. Now, a new attempt at a ceasefire between the Sudanese army and rival paramilitary group has failed, leaving people fearful of dwindling food supplies and a shutdown of hospitals and medical services. 24-hour truce was supposed to kick into effect 6 p.m. local time on Wednesday, but then fighting continued to rage in the capital, Khartoum. Both the army and the Rapid Support Force had agreed to the halt to facilitate humanitarian aid, as well as safe passage for civilians and the wounded. There's also a truce deal on Tuesday, but that also failed as clashes broke out just hours later. Deadly conflict erupted Saturday after weeks of tensions over the planned integration of the paramilitary group into the regular army. That's so far left nearly 300 people dead and over 3,000 injured. The Red Cross has raised concerns over the worsening circumstances for housebound civilians. Residents have been hit with power cuts, water and food shortages, and most hospitals and medical care services are not operational. There are also reports of armed men raiding warehouses of aid supplies. We were earlier joined by political commentator Asami Hamdi and asked him about the root cause of the ongoing fighting in Sudan.
I think first and foremost, it's important to remember the context within which this is taking place, which is that you have a transition taking place in Sudan in which the parties are trying to come to some sort of agreement regarding power sharing and also trying to pressure Burhan, the head of the military council, to hand over power to civilian parties. Burhan has dragged his heels primarily because he's aware that the handover of power is essentially to civilian parties that he believes and the civilian parties themselves believe would not be able to win any seats or would not be able to win a majority in any election. The civilian parties, as part of pressuring Burhan to hand over power to him, sought to rally around Hemeti, the head of the Rapid Support Forces. They sought to rally around him and essentially try to coax him into toppling Burhan for them and then agreeing to a power-sharing transition agreement in which they would able to seize 66% of the parliament and which in which they were able to embark on ideological changes to the state before going to an elections at the time in which they believe they could win. Burhan knew that they were rallying around Hemeti, so Burhan arranged his own process through which he managed to get more civilian parties to join the process, to dilute the power of the other civilian parties, but also imposed a condition whereby the rapid support forces would have to give up much of its influence in exchange for a transition in which Burhan shares power. So Hemeti, believing that Burhan is going to take away some of his power, has decided that now is the time to act. He's moved his forces to try to topple Burhan in order essentially to oust Burhan from the game entirely and to impose himself before Burhan has a chance to rein him in and essentially clip his wings.
According to the Taiwanese media, the U.S. has significantly increased its military presence on the island, despite China's warnings, by sending over 200 troops to Taiwan. This at a time of high tensions between China and the U.S. Beijing considers Taiwan part of its territory and is against any military or diplomatic ties between the self-ruled island and any country, especially the U.S. China views this as interference in its internal matters.
The Taiwanese media reported about 200 American troops are now stationed across the island. The report cited sources who said U.S. Indo-Pacific Command deployed more than 200 personnel to Taiwan to assist the island's armed forces with training. When asked to confirm the deployment, the Pentagon declined to comment but affirmed its support for Taipei.
We don't have a comment on the specific operations, engagements, or training. But I would highlight that our support for and defense relationship with Taiwan remains aligned against the current threat posed by the People's Republic of China. Our commitment to Taiwan is rock solid and contributes to the maintenance of peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait and within the region.
The Wall Street Journal first reported in February that the U.S. planned to deploy between 100 and 200 troops to Taiwan. Among the more than 200 instructors, 80% are from the U.S. Army. Most of the American instructors are stationed at new training centers and reserve brigades of Taiwan's army. Since Washington severed diplomatic relations with Taipei in 1979, the U.S. still deployed a handful of military trainers to Taiwan. The small U.S. military presence in Taiwan was always an open secret, but was never officially confirmed until 2021, when President Tsai Ing-wen became the first Taiwanese leader to acknowledge U.S. troops were on the island since 1979. The increase in U.S. troops in Taiwan risks provoking a response from China, as Beijing has been strongly warning against growing U.S.-Taiwan ties. China's People's Liberation Army recently conducted major live-fire exercises around Taiwan. That was after U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy hosted Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen in California. Beijing is opposed to Taiwan's growing nexus with the U.S. because it considers Taiwan as part of its territory under One China principle.
Now, Taiwan is reportedly planning to buy hundreds of U.S. anti-ship missiles aimed at countering China. Report comes just days after the U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy met with the Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen in California and stressed the need to accelerate arms deliveries to Taipei.
Taiwan is reportedly in the process of buying hundreds of land-launched Harpoon anti-ship missiles from the U.S. Citing U.S.-Taiwan Business Council President Rupert Hammond Chambers and sources, Bloomberg News reported on Monday that Taiwan was poised to purchase 400 missiles under the $1.17 billion contract announced by the Pentagon on April 7th. At the time, the Pentagon said production was expected to complete by March 2029. Commenting on the news report, Taiwanese Defense Ministry announced it had previously disclosed information about the purchase, adding it was confident the deal would go according to schedule. In 2020, Taipei said it planned to obtain land-based Boeing-made Harpoon anti-ship missiles as part of its military modernization efforts. According to the report, Taiwan previously purchased the ship-launched version of Harpoon missiles, but the new contract marks the first time it will get the mobile, land-based variant. The contract with Boeing was reportedly issued by the U.S. Naval Air Systems Command on Taiwan's behalf. In reaction to the report, China's foreign ministry said it firmly opposes U.S. arms sales to Taiwan.
U.S.-Taiwan military ties and U.S. arms sales to Taiwan seriously violate the One China Principle and the three China-U.S. joint communiques, seriously damage China's sovereignty and security interests, and seriously threaten peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait. China is strongly dissatisfied and firmly opposes this.
Beijing views Taiwan as an inseparable part of China, repeatedly warning Washington against unwise provocations in this regard. China has previously warned Washington that providing the self-ruled island with advanced weaponry would breach Chinese sovereignty and do severe damage to bilateral relations.
Several EU legislators warn provoking China at the behest of the U.S. will prove economically disastrous for the 27 nation bloc citizens. Relations between the EU and China have soured since the beginning of the Ukraine war. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
It is clear that greater cooperation between China and friendly nations is making many Western leaders nervous. Analysts say US dominance is being eroded and a new world order is taking shape. The subject of EU-China relations has just been debated in the European Parliament.
The Chinese Communist Party's actions have now caught up with its stated ambitions and the hardening of China's overall strategic posture over the last years.
A clear majority in the European Parliament claim Moscow and Beijing have malign ambitions.
Russia and China have the same goal, to destroy the development of the democratic world, because democracy is a threat to both regimes.
There are those, however, who warn against provoking China.
First, you led us into conflict with Russia because it's in the interests of the USA. You forced us to buy more expensive gas from the United States. Now you are pushing us into confrontation with China because the US sees China as a threat to its world dominance.
Western leaders always turn to sanctions when they disagree with a foreign government, but they are personally insulated from the impact, experts point out.
They are well paid. Do they feel the blowback of the sanctions? Do they know what is going on in the shops? Do they know that people like you and me are constantly overcharged with all kinds of goods?
A number of lawmakers are urging EU leaders not to follow the US down a destructive path.
U.S. financial capital wants to make profits in China and in Europe. And driving a wedge between the EU and China is a good way of going about it for them.
Trade between the EU and China is currently valued at 2.3 billion euro per day. According to many economists, ordinary EU citizens will pay a huge price if the 27-country bloc falls into line with the anti-China agenda that is being developed and promoted by the United States. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
New public health research on U.S. women's prisons exposes medical neglect, sexual violence, and inhumane living conditions. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Truthout, the COVID-19 pandemic brought to the fore the public health crises unfolding in carceral settings across the United States. In California, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, CDCR, has documented more than 90,000 cases in state prisons, with more than 3,500 of those cases in women's prisons. People incarcerated in women's prisons have reported alarming neglect in CDCR's handling of the pandemic, including months spent in quarantine units, and the denial of the toilet paper, phone calls, cleaning supplies, and showers. But the health harms of incarceration existed long before the COVID-19 and continue to exist now. The recent research included interviewing and surveying people who are currently incarcerated in California's two remaining women's prisons, Central California Women's Facility, CCWF, and California Institution for Women, CIW. The findings paint a dire picture of people facing medical neglect, sexual violence, discrimination, and inhumane living conditions while incarcerated. In some ways, California's incarcerated population mirrors national social patterns. Due to the racism of the criminal legal system, 929 people in California's women's prisons were Black in 2022. This is 25% of the prison population, while Black people make up only 6.5% of California's total population. Furthermore, 83% of the survey respondents reported having an illness, injury, or disability, and 55% reported having three or more health conditions needing care. Ableism shapes how disabled people are policed, socioeconomically marginalized, and discriminated against in both the medical and legal sectors, leading disabled people to be disproportionately incarcerated. Indeed, studies show an estimated 66% of the incarcerated population in the U.S. is disabled, an estimated 40.4% with a psychiatric disability, and an estimated 56% with a non-psychiatric disability. Specifically, estimations show that a higher percentage of people incarcerated in women's prisons reported disability, 79.5%, compared with people incarcerated in men's prisons, 64.6%. This is particularly troubling considering medical neglect is characteristic of incarceration. They found that 66% of the surveyed respondents reported that medical staff did not properly treat them. 60% reported that medical staff did not investigate the cause of their medical condition, and 51% reported that medical staff did not order diagnostic tests. A Additionally, an alarming 40% of the survey respondents reported experiencing reproductive abuse, such as coerced sterilization or an untreated reproductive health issue while imprisoned. Several respondents shared that they woke up from unrelated surgeries to find that their ovaries or uterus had been removed. One woman said that she was waiting for paperwork from a surgery 2 years prior to find out if she was sterilized. This is part of a long and sordid history of marginalized Californians facing reproductive abuse. Last year, Governor Gavin Newsom allocated funds for a new program to compensate survivors of a state-sponsored sterilization, acknowledging the state's shameful past. The research found that such injustices still occur today in the U.S., and the governor has the opportunity and obligation to address them further. Also, according to China Daily, U.S. state and federal prisons saw deaths surging nearly 50% during the first year of the pandemic, and in six states, they more than doubled. The New York Times reported recently, citing the first comprehensive data on prison facilities in the era of COVID-19. The U.S. Daily said the tremendous jump in deaths in 2020 was more than twice the increase in the United States overall and even exceeded estimates of the percentage increase at nursing homes among the hardest hit sectors nationwide. While there was ample evidence that prisons were COVID hotspots, the data underscored how quickly the virus rampaged through crowded facilities and how an aging inmate population, a correctional staffing shortage, and ill-equipped medical personnel combined to make prisoners especially vulnerable during the worst public health crisis in a century, according to the report. COVID infections drove the death totals, but inmates also succumbed to other illnesses, suicide and violence, according to the data, which was collected by law school researchers at the University of California, Los Angeles. Altogether, at least 6,182 people died in American prisons in 2020, compared with 4,240 the previous year, even as the country's prison population declined to about 1.3 million from more than 1.4 million, the report said.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
As-salamu alayka ya Amin Allah fi ardi.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam,
the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: من وضع نفسه مواضع التهمة فلا يلومن من أساء به الظن.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "He who puts himself in conditions of ill repute should not blame those who entertain bad ideas about him."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and we're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Dear friends, the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is truly universal. And we say so because we find that even after the passing of well over 1,000 years, which is truly a long time, we find that despite the passing of well over 1,000 years, the statements and the behaviors and the manners and the decisions and the characteristics and qualities and persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam are still very much applicable to this present day and age. Now, this can only come about if an individual is connected to the creator of time, the creator of space, and truly the source of knowledge and wisdom, that is the Almighty Allah. In this holy month of Ramadan, we can benefit so much from the beautiful statements of Imam Ali alayhi salam. One such statement which we find from Imam Ali alayhi salam is where His Eminence says, "Ease and peace of mind will never come to a person who is jealous." In today's day and age, where everybody is looking for just a little bit of ease and peace of mind, this statement from Imam Ali seems like a golden prescription given to us by a doctor, a physician who is connected to the divine. Are we not all looking for peace of mind, even if it is just a little bit? Imam Ali alayhi salam says to us that if you are a person who has the quality of being jealous, then ease and peace of mind will never come to you. It is such a beautiful statement, it is such a simple statement, but when you go into the depths of this statement from Imam Ali and this universal persona, we find that the spiritual aspects of it can be clearly seen. If, God forbid, we suffer from this negative quality of being jealous, or perhaps if we have seen other people who are jealous, you will notice that a person who is jealous has this kind of incessant greed within them. First off, they're never satisfied with what they have because they want what others have. Two, they're constantly looking at what others have, and thus they overlook what they themselves have. These two things, among the many other repercussions and consequences of being jealous, these two things alone destroy the peace of mind and tranquility of an individual. And so, dear friends, if we want to have that peace of mind, if we want to have tranquility and serenity in our lives, if we want to have ease as far as our mind and our soul and even our body goes, then we must give up this negative and bad quality, this negative habit of being jealous. And so, when we are not a jealous person, we will achieve, to some extent, that peace of mind that we are all searching for. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRab English Radio, the program To My Brother. This moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
السلام عليك يا أمين الله في أرضه وحجته على عباده السلام عليك يا أمير
المؤمنين. Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah to administer His earth and to convince the mankind to accept His plan. Peace be upon you, O Amir al-Mu'mineen. I testify that you made utmost efforts, as it should be, in the cause of Allah, acted upon His book, followed the way of life of His Prophet, blessings of Allah be on him and his children, to the last moment of your life, until Allah invited you to come unto Him, and used His discretion to take you away and sealed your enemy's doom with the blame that the arguments had been made known to one and all through you. O Allah, let me be happy and satisfied with that which Thou considers good for me. Let me agree with that which Thou decides for me. Let me passionately remember Thee and invoke Thee. Let me be in love with Thy pure and sincere friends. Let me be well-liked and respected on the earth and in the heavens. Let me be unruffled and well-composed in the midst of misfortunes. Let me be gratefully thankful in prosperity. Let me be mindful of much and more bounties. Let me ardently desire for the heart-warming meeting with Thee, well-equipped with piety to gain my end on the day of requital. Let me follow into the footsteps of Thy representatives. Let me disassociate myself from the mannerism of Thy enemies. Let me pass my time in this world by praising and glorifying Thee.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Ali is Waliullah in the meaning of the beloved of Allah. And this is confirmed in the 7th year of the Hijrah because of the political situation in the Arabian Peninsula. The Prophet had to march against the Jewish tribe of Khaybar. There are many fortresses there, and most of them were very easily conquered by the Muslim army. However, there was one under the command of Marhab, where Muslims went and tried. Prominent companions led the Muslim army, but failed, came back. And this is their history. One of them came back and complained to the Prophet that the army ran away. The army came later on and said, Rasulullah, the commander went away. You know, so different situations happened. And finally Rasulullah said, okay, he announced that be prepared tomorrow. لَعُتِيَنَّ الرَّأْيَ غَدًا Tomorrow I am giving the flag of leadership and command رَجُلًا to a man يُحِبُّ اللَّهَ وَرَسُولُهُ who loves Allah and His Messenger وَيُحِبُّهُ اللَّهُ وَرَسُولُهُ and Allah and His Messenger also loves him كَرَّارًا غَيْرَ فَرَّارًا He is a fighter, not a runaway لا يرجو حتى يفتح الله على يديه. He will not return until Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gives victory in his hands. According to historians, and I was looking at even people like Shibli Nu'mani, a very prominent Sunni alim of Indian subcontinent in this century, he says all the Sahaba were, you know, praying that, you know, may Rasul select me. Even those who sometimes used to say, we are not into position, they said that at least that night I had this desire that may I be selected. Next morning, all of them gathered outside the tent of Rasulullah. Rasulullah comes out. Nobody volunteered for that position. Why? It wasn't an occasion of volunteering your name. Because the first part you could say, يُحِبُّ اللَّهَ وَرَسُولُهُ that you love Allah and Rasul. The second part, يُحِبُّهُ اللَّهُ وَرَسُولُهُ that Allah and the Rasul also loves him. So there was no matter of asking somebody to volunteer that position. Rasulullah looked around and everybody was thinking, maybe his eyes will fall on me or me or me, and then he didn't see the one whom he wanted to see. And he asked them, Aina Ali? Where is Ali? Quickly they said, oh, Ali is not feeling well. His eyes are hurting. Rasulullah didn't stop there. You know, Rasulullah said, doesn't matter, call him. He comes. And Rasulullah called him close, took the saliva from his tongue, put it in his eyes. This is even in Sunni historians and Shia narrations also. Right away,
Amir al-Mu'mineen was cured of the pain and the ailment that he had in his eyes. And Rasulullah gave him the alam and the command. And he goes, and you know the rest of the story, how he was able to conquer the fortress of Khaybar under the command of Marhab.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Twenty years ago, on March 16, 2003, a Zionist regime's military bulldozer crushed American Solidarity activist Rachel Corrie to death a few kilometers away from Rafah in the Gaza Strip. She was one of several International Solidarity Movement ISM activists trying to stop the demolition of Palestinian homes there. The then Zionist regime's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon had launched a campaign to destroy thousands of Palestinian homes to establish a buffer zone on the Palestinian-Egyptian border. ISM activists arrived in the area to express humanitarian solidarity with civilians facing the Zionist regime's occupation machine. This machine was and is generously supported by the United States regime, Rachel's homeland. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International wrote, 20 years ago today, an Israeli bulldozer crushed Rachel Corrie to death in the Gaza Strip. The 23-year-old American peace activist had tried to prevent the armored bulldozer from demolishing the house of a Palestinian family in the Rafah refugee camp in Gaza. The Israeli bulldozer driver deliberately drove his machine over her crushing her to death. It was an act of cold-blooded murder of an innocent person whose only crime was to prevent an Israeli crime from occurring. She paid the price with her life. Has anyone been held accountable for this despicable cold-blooded murder? Perish the thought. Zionist Israel can do no wrong even when it kills American citizens. After each Israeli crime, the American regime shovels more billions in aid to the parasitical state. Rachel's parents, Cindy and Kerry Corey, have tried everything in their power to hold someone accountable for the murder of their young daughter. The lodged legal challenges against the Zionist regime's military and the Texas-based Caterpillar Incorporation, the bulldozer's manufacturer, but their efforts failed. Even the Zionist regime Supreme Court dismissed their appeal. This flawed Israeli judicial system is currently being gutted further by Benjamin Netanyahu and his gang of convicted criminals in order to save their hides. Rachel Corey's parents also said they have been unable to impact America's policy towards the Zionist regime. They have come to realize that with few exceptions, top elected officials of both parties in the U.S. provide unquestioning support to the Zionist regime. As Cindy Sheehan, the mother of a young American soldier, Casey, who was killed on his first day of duty in Iraq in April 2004, said, "There is only one party in America. That is the war party." The Zionist Israel is part of this warmongering ideology. American lawmakers fall over themselves to prove their loyalty to the fabricated regime of Israel, the racist entity ruled by neo-Nazis. The current occupant of the White House, Joe Biden, is an unabashed, self-declared Zionist. He has repeatedly said, "You do not have to be a Jew to be a Zionist." While Palestinian lives do not matter to American officials, they do not care for even American lives if the perpetrators of the crime are Israeli Zionists. Shirin Abu Akleh, the Palestinian-American journalist, was deliberately targeted by an Israeli regime sniper, even though he knew she was a journalist and only doing her job. On June 8, 1967, the Zionist regime's Air Force deliberately targeted the American ship USS Liberty in the Mediterranean. It was on an intelligence mission, monitoring the Israeli regime attack on Egypt, Syria, Jordan, etc., in what came to be called the Six-Day War. The Zionist regime's attack lasted more than 2 hours and left 34 American sailors dead and another 171 injured. Did America hold the Israeli regime accountable for this crime in international waters? Far from doing so, the Zionist regime was showered with more billions. Then American President Lyndon Johnson and his Secretary of War, Robert McNamara, hushed up the matter. The USS Liberty was on official duty. If American officials did not care for their own sailors on duty, why would they care if a lone peace activist, Rachel Corey, is brutally murdered by the Israelis? Palestinians, meanwhile, planted an olive tree on the spot where Rachel Corey was crushed to death 20 years ago. She may be dead, but her memory lives on. A day will come when the Zionist criminals will be held accountable for their numerous crimes against the Palestinians, as well as other people who believe in peace and justice. According to Palestine Chronicle, 20 years ago, American peace activist Rachel Corrie was killed by an Israeli bulldozer that was preparing to demolish a Palestinian home in southern Gaza. On March 16, 2003, 2 years before the Zionist regime's withdrawal from Gaza, Corrie acted as a human shield in hopes of stopping a bulldozer operated by Israeli regime forces from demolishing a home in the Palestinian Rafah refugee camp. The Zionist regime forces operating a 60-ton D9 bulldozer built by Caterpillar Incorporation continued moving toward Corrie as she stood her ground, running her over. 20 minutes after the bulldozer backed away, Corrie was pronounced dead. The Zionist regime has since denied claims of responsibility, saying the incident was an accident and accusing Corrie and other activists of illegal activity. Born on April 10, 1979, in Olympia, Washington, Corrie dedicated her life to defending Palestinian rights. In 2003, she went to the Gaza Strip as a member of the International Solidarity Movement. She was known for her love of peace and for defending Palestinian rights, frequently broadcasting photo essays exposing Israeli rights violations in the occupied territories. The people of Gaza received news of her murder with grief and horror, describing her as a martyr and staging a massive funeral for the American activist. Also, Common Dreams reported Palestinian rights activists remembered the life and legacy of Rachel Corrie recently, the American human rights defender who was crushed to death by an Israeli regime military bulldozer on March 16, 2003, while trying to shield a Palestinian home from demolition in occupied Gaza. Rachel was 23 when she was killed. She could have satisfied her conscience by protesting against global injustice in a demonstration in America or by calling for a boycott of the aggressors. Palestinian journalist and activist Ahmad Abu Artema, who is from Rafah, where Corrie was killed, wrote for Mondowe's website. He added, "But her high sense of morality was not satisfied with these symbolic gestures. Her conscience would not rest without complete involvement, without standing side by side with us. That's why she came to Palestine." Hanan Ashrawi, a Palestinian politician, scholar and activist, called Corrie an icon of resistance, freedom and self-sacrifice. She added, "Palestine is forever grateful, always in our hearts, rest in love and peace."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.